The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio. And you're very welcome to The Greg Hughes Show on this Monday morning. It is Monday, the 20th of April. Donal in the hot seat for Greg today and indeed during the week as well. Looking forward to your company over the course of the next 2 hours. A lot to get through on the programme, as is always the case. But as we always say, the most important thing here is your perspectives, your views and your take on the stories and issues of the day. You can get in touch with the station. You can call us on 07491 25000. You can text or WhatsApp us on 086 60 25000. We're also available through social media and other areas as well online. We're on Facebook, on Highland Hub, we're on X at Highland Radio. You can of course watch the show unfold on our Facebook pages and also on our YouTube channel as well, which is Highland Radio Ireland. Looking at the newspapers this morning, as we always do, and the front cover of the Donegal News this morning, a poignant picture of the coffin of Moira Brennan being taken from St Patrick's Church at Meanwheel in Crawley after her funeral service on Friday afternoon last, before being brought to Maharagallan for burial. And a very sad day indeed, as Moya was taken to her eternal rest following her death on Monday of last week. Lots of tributes paid over the course of the week, of course, every single one of them deserved, and indeed lots more besides. Looking at the stories in the newspaper, an interesting one: Letterkenny Bus Shelter to expand to meet growing demand. Plans in the pipeline for a bigger and improved bus shelter near the Mr. Chibi car park in Letterkenny. Now, we do know there is a long-term plan to develop a transport hub in Letterkenny. Now, it's going at Pierce Road. If you're on Pierce Road, just opposite Chili Shaker there, beside Lanealy House, there is a area in there that's completely overgrown at the moment. There used to be a bacon factory in there, I think. And if I recall correctly, there were civil defence offices in there at one point as well. Now, that's going back a fair few years, but I seem to recall a civil defence office in there when you could still get in that gate and actually drive down it. But that's now a completely overgrown area. The plan in the long term is to develop a transport hub there, and that's part of that wider Letterkenny transport plan that's been approved by council over the course of the past number of years. But in the meantime, what's going to happen is that bus stop there, just close to Station Roundabout, is going to be the effective transport hub in Letterkenny for quite a few years before we see the main transport hub developed. So it is going to be made bigger. There's going to be shelter provided, some seating provided. At the moment, there is nowhere for someone to sit. There is nowhere, even realistically speaking, for more than five or six people to shelter. So looking at getting something more permanent there. And ultimately, the aim, as we said, is to get people away from that area and get them to a new transport hub. But that is, as we say, some years down the line as of yet. Irish Independent, interesting story in the paper this morning. 3 in 4 voters don't believe that Gerry Adams claimed that he wasn't in the IRA. Suzanne Breen writes that 3 in 4 voters don't believe Gerry Adams when he says he wasn't in the IRA. That's according to a Lucid Talk poll in Northern Ireland. More nationalists believe the former Sinn Féin president isn't telling the truth when he says he wasn't a member than accept his denials as accurate. Half the party's own voters believe Mr. Adams on the issue, a third don't, and for an overwhelming majority of people across the political spectrum. However, the matter has no impact, they say, on how they would vote in a general election. The Irish Times this morning: 248 US military flights over Ireland went unreported due to an admin error. Story there on the front of the Irish Times. Also on the Times: Daniel Kinahan trial in Ireland poses unprecedented security concerns. That's potentially going to happen down the line after he was arrested last week in the United Arab Emirates. And also, Ireland to seek cut in EU tax on imported US aviation fuel in order to ease airline cost crisis. That's the Irish Times. Irish Daily Mail, some interesting stories. Martin vows to lead Fianna Fáil into the next election. That's one of those stories that's appearing across a number of papers this morning. Micheál Martin did address his party's 1916 commemoration yesterday. And speaking at that, he insisted he will lead the party into the next election. And he says the sense he gets from Fianna Fáil members is very supportive and warm. Now, there are two perspectives on what the situation is with Micheál Martin. How much has he been damaged by the protests and the fuel crisis and the presidential debacle that happened toward the end of last year? That's one question. Balanced against that is the belief and the perspective that Micheál Martin is very anxious to beat Taoiseach over the course of the Irish EU presidency, which starts in June and lasts until December. So Micheál Martin absolutely adamant he wants to be Taoiseach over the course of Ireland's EU presidency. And as we say, that starts in June. So he will certainly, he would be holding on and working to hold on until December. The question then becomes, does he stay on as leader, go back to being Taoiseach when presumably Simon Harris takes over as Taoiseach after the rotation takes place over the course of this government term? Does Micheál Martin stay on, go back to being Taoiseach and work under Simon Harris as Taoiseach until the next election and then lead Fianna Fáil in with a view toward trying to get a situation where Fianna Fáil is the majority party in government and he can be Taoiseach for 5 years? Or does he, after the EU presidency, at that point, do we have a situation where Fianna Fáil go, okay, it's time for a change? Now, the question is, who is going to heave against him? And look, there's been so much discussion about this over the years. I mean, there's no point in rehashing all those discussions again. But we know, for instance, that there has been a lot of talk about Jim O'Callaghan in the past year or so. Question now is, of course, after the fuel protests and Jim O'Callaghan's association with the threat to bring in the army, which turned out to be a huge element in that whole week of news and that cycle. Has Jim O'Callaghan damaged himself? There was a lot of talk previously about Jack Chambers, but given Jack Chambers' closeness to Jim Gavin and Jack Chambers' involvement in the presidential nomination, how much has that damaged Jim, Jack Chambers in the longer term? So you're left with a number of names then. Do we potentially get a heave from someone like Dara O'Brien, the former housing minister, now transport minister, or do we get a heave from someone like Dara Cleary? So we'll have to see what happens there. There's a lot of discussion to be had, but you can be sure that Fianna Fáil leadership question is not going to go away and is going to stay an issue for quite some time, I suspect. The Irish Sun this morning. Main story, Kinahan's Dubai downfall. Cops not down by a long shot. Investigators behind the arrest of Daniel Kinahan in Dubai have sent a defiant message to the remaining leaders of his mob, declaring we're not done yet. Cops are trying to nail his brother Christopher and his dad Christy after cartel member Sean McGovern pleaded guilty to directing the activities of a criminal organisation. And as we said, that one is going to run and run. Irish Daily Mirror, looking on the inside, Vogue reveals agony of two miscarriages. Vogue Williams has spoken candidly about enduring two miscarriages before becoming pregnant with her fourth child. The 40-year-old revealed last week she is expecting again, said felt like her body had failed her and the loss has left her nervous throughout her current pregnancy, and that is absolutely understandable. And look, here's the thing, whether you're Vogue Williams and you're in the public eye or whether you're Siobhan and you work in a shop, it does not matter who you are when you have had that experience of a miscarriage. And as a man, I can only try to imagine and put myself into that position, which obviously I cannot do. But, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're Vogue Williams or whether you're anyone, whoever you are, that level of fear, having had one miscarriage and potentially having another, it must be a terrible thing. And look, we wish her well, and that's all we can do. Well, look at some comments actually that have come in over the course of the last Friday and over the weekend, because obviously Greg would have had a number of discussions taking place, and we'll just bring some of the updates to you. In terms of fuel, caller says more than 50% of fuel prices are pure government taxes and levies, so the argument that it cannot be reduced is untrue, and that is a very fair and accurate point. Now, the government also saying it's slightly hamstrung by EU regulations, and there is that whole discussion, and it's not going away anytime soon. Caller makes an interesting point. My grandson is doing TY, transition year. I had a very interesting conversation with him about it. Many have to find a place of work for the year themselves. Very often they're exploited by the employers, doing meaningless jobs that staff won't do. Very little training or interest in them is given. They're often treated like an inconvenience. No transport is provided to those venues, which can be expensive for families. Many of the children feel bitter because they feel unappreciated by the businesses. The schools do very little follow-up with them to ensure that they're not being exploited or even turn up. I feel the education system is very much letting them down in this transition year. How do others feel about it? It's an interesting point. Now, we do have transition year people come into Highland on a regular basis, like many businesses do. Now, what I can tell you is that when you bring someone into a business, you cannot take someone who's in transition year and put them in a position of responsibility. It wouldn't be fair on them. It would be unfair on everybody. So I suppose within the context of every business, what you have to do is find something that they can do where they get to understand things like being in employment, being in a job, being in a workplace, and the fact that a workplace is going to be different from school, and that there's going to be different levels of expectation, and there's going to be different things to be done. Yes, they will indeed in all cases start, for want of a better phrase, they will have to start doing what will appear to be menial things. But you know what? Every job, people do menial things. And we all do it. I mean, you know, and yeah, certainly here on a radio station, there's a, you know, there's a certain, I suppose, public persona and there's a public profile and people are on air and people are seen doing this and it seems that's all great. And believe you me, there is a lot of work goes on behind the scenes on a radio station as well. And there's a lot of people in this building. And if someone like me is on air and is sounding good, that's because we have a backup team behind us that are making us sound good. And the fact is, on a radio station, just like everybody else, there's a level of glamour from the outside. And inside, it can be a very, very different story. And I suspect every work experience is going to be a bit like that, because people will look at something from the outside with a certain perspective. I remember Bob Geldof in his autobiography, Is That It? Many, many years ago when I read it, had a very interesting comment. And he said, record companies are like wives. Everybody wants everybody else's. And you could almost say the same things about jobs, because I know people look at my job and say, God, look at the job he has. Isn't that fantastic? I mean, what better job could you have? I guarantee you, I look at my friends and I look at their jobs and I say exactly the same thing on a regular basis. I want to talk about Leo Varadkar for a moment, and this is something we may get back to over the course of the programme. Leo Varadkar has sparked a major debate about who really funds Ireland, claiming that urban Ireland is subsidising rural Ireland. Now, during the defective block crisis, this is the man who said the 100% redress campaign as homeowners were placing an unfair burden on the taxpayer, despite the fact that those families were victims of state regulatory failure and their homes were literally falling apart around them. So as a homeowner who has now rebuilt at a huge cost to myself and to my family, I'm not surprised by this statement. And it is an interesting one. And you do hear this coming out before, that people will say, oh, Dublin is paying all the taxes and rural Ireland and places like Donegal are getting all the benefits. Now, I did read a number of reactions to that over the course of the weekend as well, which suggested that not everybody has taken those comments from the former Taoiseach at face value. So let's throw this one open. What do you think about Leo Varadkar's comment? Is the rural population of this country effectively sponging off the donations and the taxes of urban Ireland, and are we being subsidised by those who live in the big cities? It's an interesting one. Over to you. Now, there's been an increase in the number of uninsured cars on Irish roads, almost 105,000 uninsured private cars in 2025. That compares with almost 102,000 the previous year. One in every 15 cars on the road were unregistered last year. That's according to the Motor Insurers Bureau of Ireland. Now, its chief executive is David Fitzgerald, and he joins us on the programme. David, good morning.
Good morning.
David, in terms of this statistic, it is a worrying one. And we know that the government has been looking very much at compliance with road regulations and so on over the past number of years. We're also hearing, though, that there is a reduction in the number of Gardaí involved in roads policing, that there's a clawback in the number of vehicles, there's a reduction in the number of Gardaí, and as a result, there's a reduction in the number of checkpoints. Do you believe there's a link between that and this statistic you've just published?
So to answer your question, you're asking about Garda checkpoints and resources. Certainly, we'd always welcome more resources to the Gardaí. I mean, IMID made a very big difference initially, our Irish Motor Insurance Database. So when we brought it in 2024, we saw a step change in the reduction of uninsured vehicles. We were up at more than 8%, and we saw that fall to 4.2% for private vehicles and 6.7% overall. So that made a real change. But disappointingly, that improvement has leveled off in 2025. So we're looking at other mechanisms as to how we could help the Gardaí, looking across at Europe. You know, why are we so high compared to the European averages? So in the EU average, you know, when we've talked to similar bodies, is 2.4%, and it's 2.5% in our closest neighbour, the UK, and they have systems of continuous insurance, and that's what we're calling for today as part of this research. We're calling for a change in legislation to move towards continuous vehicle coverage.
Effectively, are you saying then that a insurer will automatically renew a policy if they haven't had a strict instruction not to do so from the insuree?
A little different than that. So at the moment in Ireland, it's not an offence to own an uninsured vehicle. It's only an offence to drive it. And that's out of step with the system used in almost all countries in Europe. So there's 25 countries, including the UK and Europe, that are using a system of continuous insurance, what we're calling continuous vehicle coverage. Right. And what that means is that the owner of the vehicle is obliged to maintain third-party liability insurance on the vehicle at all times to protect the victims. So what that would do is that, you know, the Gardaí are doing very good work, you know, identifying uninsured drivers and new technology, but they have to catch them in the act. So this, in the first step, would move it towards an administrative process. So a warning letter could be sent to those people. You know, we can use the IMED data to identify who they are. A warning letter could be sent to give them a, you know, a reasonable amount of time to get their house in order, to buy insurance, or if there's a problem with the data, that can be fixed. Then the next step then would be a fine. That's what they do in the UK. And then if people fail to engage at that point, then it becomes a matter for the police.
Yeah. Does that then rule out, I know there is, can be a situation, say, if somebody is ill or if somebody is out of the country, if somebody is not going to be using their car effectively, they can put a freeze on the insurance for 3, 4, 5 months or whatever on the basis that the car is going to be in the driveway and it's not going to be driven. Does this system rule that out?
No, it doesn't. I think that can absolutely be catered for. So what they do in the UK is they have a statutory off-road notification, so, you know, a formal declaration that it's not going to be driven for a period of time, and then, you know, those people wouldn't be bothered, you know, under this system. But what we would do is we'd have a list of those vehicles, and the, you know, the Gardaí would have that in a hot list, so they could be keeping an eye for anybody who is abusing the system. But people genuinely who had, you know, the car laid up in the driveway in the scenario that you describe, you know, that wouldn't impact their ability to do that.
In terms of your discussions with government and with the department, are you getting any sense from them that they will legislate for this, that we will see this continuous insurance model actually being brought into legislation?
We've had positive initial discussions, so it will require a change to road traffic legislation. So, you know, we're realistic that it can't be done overnight. It'll need to be, you know, properly planned out for and legislated for. But we have met with the Department of Transport, Finance and the Gardaí, and you know, they have received the proposal warmly. And we think now is the time on the back of, you know, announcing these figures. You know, this plateauing of uninsured figures is now the time to start working on it and plan to include it in the next round of road traffic legislation, you know, that gets updated every few years.
From the point of view of your own members, this is always going to be a concern. And we do know there is a fund that if somebody is involved in a collision involving an uninsured vehicle, that there is a fund there that can actually cover them to a certain extent. How does that operate, and does that continue to be a factor?
Yeah, so we run that fund in the Motor Insurers Bureau of Ireland. So we compensate the victims of any accident caused by an uninsured driver, or indeed a hit and run type driver, what we call an untraced claim. And that's fully funded by a levy on everybody's motor insurance policy. So it's great we can look after the victims, but it's not victimless in the sense that, you know, there's a financial levy on all onerous motorist policies. So we pay out 60 to 70 million euros in compensation every year. So whatever we can do to reduce uninsured driving, reduce that cost, and, you know, that should be good news for consumers. And, you know, it's also a road safety issue. We do find uninsured drivers to be riskier and involved in more serious accidents than the average motorist. So, you know, if we can get those uninsured drivers off the road, that would be a good thing for all the motorists.
And if that figure were to come down, presumably there would be a decrease in the insurance premiums being paid by you and I and everybody listening, because ultimately, as you say, the 60 to 70 million euro paid out every year, it isn't coming from some magic pot buried at the end of a rainbow. It's coming from our policies.
Exactly. We estimate it's around about 30 euros in everybody's policy to cover the cost of uninsured driving. So whatever we can do to reduce that, I think it should help everybody.
David Fitzgerald, Chief Executive of the Motor Insurance Bureau of Ireland. Thanks very much indeed, David, for speaking to us this morning. It's an interesting one.
We'll
be keeping an eye on this. I want to go to Zoom because standing by is Anya Flynn, and Anya is the Director of the Decision Support Service in Ireland, which is a very important body, and they're having a public meeting in Donegal very shortly. Anya, good morning to you.
Good morning, Donal. Thank you for having me.
It's our absolute pleasure. Anya, talk to us about the Decision Support Service, because it is a very, very important thing, and there have been changes in the way this operates recently.
Thanks. Yes, we are the decision support service established under a piece of law called the Assisted Decision-Making Capacity Act. And we're coming up to our third birthday now as an operational service. The Act came fully into operation in April of 2023. So it's an act which does a lot. It's a big piece of reforming legislation, as you say. It repeals the wards of court system, which some of your listeners might be familiar with. It establishes us. So we have a range of functions to do with the new framework of supports. We promote, we provide information, we register and we supervise decision support arrangements. And one of those arrangements is the enduring power of attorney. That's a really important tool for planning ahead together with the Advanced Healthcare Directive. And that's primarily what we'll be talking about when we come to Ballybuffet in a couple of weeks' time. It's really what makes the Act an act for everybody, because none of us knows when at a future point we might lose the ability to make our own decisions.
And there have been changes, because it was perhaps previously just about refilling in a paper form and getting it signed. Now it's somewhat more complicated and the focus is online rather than on paper.
Well, the enduring power of attorney has been an option for people since 1996, since an act of that year. And during those almost 30 years, it operated in a somewhat different way. You're right, the changes have been made. We're keen to improve the take-up that has applied under the old act, with only about 8 to 11% of people making enduring powers of attorney, those that could. And that compares quite unfavourably with how things are in the UK, where the numbers would be in excess of 20% in England and Wales and in Scotland. So under the old system, and if anybody has an EPA, by the way, that they made before April 2023, then they're fine. They've done one under the old act and it's still valid. Under the old act, it tended to be the practice that people went to a solicitor, they made the document, and there was no kind of first stage beyond that. Then if they lost capacity subsequently, that enduring power of attorney had to be registered in the High Court. So what has changed is that now when you make an enduring power of attorney, you do that with us, with the Decision Support Service. We charge a fee of €30 for that. It's registered with us. We check that it's going to work. Should it be required in the future, we carry out a review to ensure that it's compliant. And then it goes on a searchable register, only to be called upon later if that's necessary. Perhaps just to state a few of the basics, Donal, if I may. When you make an EPA, you're called a donor. So you're giving at a future point in time, if the need arises, the authority to somebody close to you to make your decisions. And that person's called your attorney. And that doesn't mean solicitor. It's somebody, very often a spouse or partner or a grown-up child, who's going to step in as your decision maker. And that only comes into effect, obviously, if you lose capacity at a future point, which could be as a consequence of an acquired brain injury, a declining illness, something like that. So it's a kind of insurance policy for your future to ensure that people are going to be able to make decisions, that your named and trusted person is going to be able to make your decisions about your property and affairs and or your personal welfare. And we've seen a good level of take up. We're not just online, we're not just digital, we're digital first, but not digital only. So we do have an alternative processes to facilitate anybody who's difficulty engaging with the online system. But the take up has been increasing, and we're confident that that will continue. So that we now have registered in excess of 6,000 enduring powers of attorney. There are about another 3,000 approximately in the queue for review and registration. So that's increasing all the time. The huge majority of those, in fact, were made just in the last 12 months.
How is incapacitation determined? And do situations emerge where a person that has been given power of attorney attempts to exercise it, but there's a question mark over whether there is incapacity in the first place? And I know it's the sort of thing you see on TV and you think that couldn't happen in real life, but the question is, does it?
Oh, we see all the things gone wrong, but mostly people don't. You know, people operate conscientiously and out of love and loyalty for the people close to them. Of course they do. But that's really interesting. So capacity has a particular meaning under this act. So it isn't, do you have dementia? Do you have an acquired brain injury? Do you have an intellectual disability? Instead, it's moved to what is called a functional test of capacity. It's about your ability to decide a particular thing at a particular time. So to make an enduring power of attorney, you establish that you have capacity to make one, that you know what you're about. And then it would only, as I RSA come into play when capacity, when incapacity is established. And that has to be by way of a professional assessment that you've now lost the ability in that functional way to make the decisions covered by the EPA. So it's about how you engage with information. Can you understand information, retain it, weigh it up and communicate what you want to do? So move away, from, if you like, from a strictly medical approach. And as to when things might go wrong, new under this Act is an extra level of oversight and supervision, so that when you make an enduring power of attorney, and again then at second stage, there is an opportunity for those close to you who are called your notice parties to say, well, hang on, Dad doesn't have capacity to make one, sadly, or at second stage, Dad's fine, what are you talking about? You know, there's no need for this EPA to be taken into, to be made operative, because he's still fine to make his own decisions. So we have to weigh up and consider those facts when they're presented to us as well. And then what is also new is that we actually supervise the attorney carrying out their role in a supportive way, as we're not there to catch anybody out. Most people do this superbly well, but they do have to turn in reports to us to show that they're managing the affairs correctly. Most people make a very general form of EPA, granting a general authority to that person close to them to make their decisions for them. But it is a really important way to kind of take control. Your capacity could shift and change, but there's no reason for your control to change if you plan ahead in this way. And that's what we strongly encourage people to do.
And it is a huge responsibility to take on. And in some cases, it could be a very emotional consideration to take on, because, I mean, you are dealing, in many cases, you're dealing, it's not an intellectual exercise. It's the well-being and welfare of a loved one. From that point of view, and it's really important that people understand every element of this, and from that point of view, there is a public information evening and a one-to-one help desk taking place at the Villa Rose next month in May. Tell us about that, because this could potentially be a very important event for someone who's looking into becoming a power of attorney, or indeed giving somebody else power of attorney.
Exactly. Thinking about taking these important steps to plan ahead, putting this insurance in place. So yeah, we are coming, Donald, to the Villa Rose in Ballybuffet. So there'll be an information evening, first of all, on Tuesday the 5th of May. And that's from 6 p.m. there, to hear about the Act generally, but really focusing on these tools for planning ahead. Because there's an advanced care directive as well. You can't plan ahead for medical treatment in an EPA. So there's a separate document called an AHD information on that also. And then we take our EPA help desk on tour sometimes. So that's what you'll see on the following day. We have a full day event where people from our EPA help desk team will be there seeing people by appointment, whatever stage they might be at with their EPA journey, whether they're getting going with opening an account with us and putting the documentation in place, or whether they perhaps hit a bump in the road. And want some particular help with that. So these events have gone really well to date. We have done them in, I think, 5 locations regionally up to this point, and to now coming to Donegal, where we have local partners as well who are going to be helping us with that. Advanced booking is needed. So let me give you the number, if I may. It's a free phone number, 01211 9750, or you can email us at epahelpdesk@decisionsupportservice.ie. That help desk is available for all kinds of queries. You don't have to wait for the help desk to come to your town in order to make an EPA, obviously. We have living, breathing people on the ends of the phones all the time dealing with these queries. And in fact, we have just collated all of our EPA information resources into one place on the Decision Support Service website. So you can go straight to myepa.ie and get lots of information in different formats, including informational videos stepping you through the stages for how to get going with your EPA and get it across to us. Really important, as we also say, one piece of misinformation that we're always keen to counter is this idea that, sure, if I don't do this, my next of kin will just step in and all shall be well. We call that the next of kin myth, because actually that person close to you, whether it's your spouse, your partner, your grown-up child, actually has no legal authority to take care of your affairs or your personal welfare decision making if you lose the ability to do so. An adult does not get to decide for another adult outside of a legal arrangement. And that's nothing new that the Act has done. That was never the case. So really important to take control. People sometimes think, but I only have one child, there won't be a row, or I don't own very much, but that doesn't take care of things. It's really important to have these arrangements in place. Otherwise, you could end up the subject of an application to court. And obviously, that's a certain loss of control with an uncertain outcome.
Mm. I must confess, I would have almost fell victim to that myth myself, because I would have just assumed that my wife and vice versa. Yes, indeed. So that's...
really common, and we're not helped by the fact that your next of kin still appears in informal documentation. So it's one of our one of the aspects of our public information campaign to try to challenge that. And our public information campaign, people might become aware of it over the next weeks and months, because we're trying to step up our advocacy around this and improve people's knowledge of the importance of planning ahead. So the Donegal event is just one part of that. But lots of information available from decisionsupportservice.ie and that EPA microsite, if you like, in particular, where you'll find out an awful lot more.
This is certainly one to be thinking about, and myepa.ie, I think all of us could do, and I had myself in this, all of us could do with a visit there, and particularly those of us that aren't getting any younger. In the meantime, Anya, thank you very much indeed.
Not at all.
It's food for thought, and hopefully we will get a good turnout at that event. It's in the Villa Rosen Hotel in Ballybuffet, 6 to 7pm on Tuesday, May 5th, and then the help desk available 10am to 4.45pm.
Yeah. And do call ahead, because we tend to be oversubscribed, but look forward to seeing everyone in Donegal.
Anya, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Donal.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you. That's Anya there from the Decision Support Service. And that is food for thought, because I will be absolutely honest. I personally would have said, absolutely, that's grand. If anything goes wrong, sure, my wife will look after me and everything is grand. And everything is perhaps not grand. So let's have a think about that. We spoke earlier about Leo Varadkar and the comments he made. Just a thought on this has come in from someone. Just a thought on Varadkar's attack on farmers and Irish people. I think we need to look and question, is it coming from his thoughts, genuine, and not coming from someone who has a grudge to bear? Varadkar leaving politics when he was Taoiseach needs to be considered. When he begins to speak, really a colossal thing to do, to walk away at the time he did. Is there a bigger story? It seems he's talking like a bitter man, so his comments are not coming from a level-headed, non-biased point. Well, that's a comment. Another caller says, considering the population of Dublin, Cork and Galway, I can understand where Leo was coming from, but the true reality is without the farmer, there most certainly will be no food, and that's more important. Caller says, in terms of the insurance issue that we were discussing earlier, what are the rules with people from other countries driving on the roads with no insurance? What will happen to the people who have a smash and end up having to pay to repair their own cars? Now, as we heard from our guest earlier from the Motor Insurance Bureau of Ireland, there is a fund which we all pay into in our own insurance policies. There is a fund which will deal with cases of accidents involving uninsured drivers. That fund is there and that can be applied to, but it's an interesting issue and certainly is one that does need to be considered. Well, it's Monday, which means the DL debate's going to be on tonight after the 7 o'clock news, and it's a rather special one tonight, coming to us live from the clubhouse at St. Tunan's out in O'Donnell Park. And the DL debate will, as always, be presented by Brendan Devaney, who joins us on Zoom. Brendan, good morning.
That's it, Donal. Big week for the club. First championship game in 75 years at the park. So, yeah, we're going to have a big championship build-up week. So it's going to be a great day for the club and for Letterkenny.
And from the point of view of Unions, I mean, you know, as you say, it is a big one. It is a championship game, and you know, it's something special for O'Donnell Park. A lot's gone into doing up O'Donnell Park over the years. A lot's gone into its development. There's been a lot of love gone into it, a lot of money gone into it, a lot of commitment gone into it. And now we've seen big National League games there. But as you say, first championship game for decades.
Yeah, first championship game for in a long, long time. Though, I guess you're looking at capacity. You know, if you're on about the big games, obviously McCool Park is the where the county team plays, and it's got the biggest capacity, you know. So it's about that, getting up to that level, maybe possibly down the line with future developments. But for now, I suppose with the redevelopment of the pitch in McCool Park, they could have to go to another venue. And I think rightfully so, you know, Letterkenny, it's the main county in the main town in the county, and it's got the best, I suppose, amenities in that for a large crowd coming. So listen, the National League games have always been brilliant out there. You know, it is a great place to come, and as I said, a lot of work being done with the club there. We're going to have a lot of club officials and members there this evening, along with like ex-county players and All-Ireland winners, Ulster winners coming, you know, like Rory Kavanagh, Charlie McGrew's going to be there, you know, Ronan McNamee's coming down from Tyrone, just to give us maybe a wee bit of outside perspective as well. Dr. Jimmy McDade, of course, who the stand's named after, put so much work into the club himself, especially his time as a minister. So we're going to have a load of people coming down, our own Brendan Kilcoyne's coming as well. And as I say, it's going to be a great night.
In terms of the guests, really important, as you said. Talk to us about the weekend and the various games that took place over the weekend. What have we learned?
Yeah, well, Doug, I was covering the games for BBC, the Antrim and Derry game and Monaghan Cavan, so it's a busy weekend. Not all as glamorous as you'd be talking about earlier in your glamorous hot seat there at the opening. I was listening to you in the opening of the show. But listen, that old back road to Clonus, as a lot of us know well, yeah, listen, I'm never that fond of it. But you know what? No traffic on it's not too bad coming my way because it was Monaghan and Cavan there yesterday. But yeah, it was an interesting enough weekend. Mm-hmm. Listen, obviously Antrim are out and out underdogs, and they did give Derry a bit of a game. There wasn't too much to be learned from it. Cavan and Monaghan was interesting yesterday. We've seen some brilliant forward play from Monaghan, and then the fight back from Cavan, and even teams that are looking out of it. I mean, they were 9-1 down, like 15 minutes or whatever into the game, and then goals in the second half, and just a bit of spirit, a bit of momentum, pulled them right back. They were back to 3 and had a couple of opportunities, and Monaghan pulled away again. So they obviously played Derry in the semi-final, Donal. So listen, that's the other side to Donegal. We play Down and Armagh play Fermanagh, and the winners of them two games, looking like Donegal and Armagh, that's going to be a massive game coming down the tracks. Donal, I just want to mention our hurlers. Our hurlers mm-hmm. were the way to carry it the weekend there in the Christie Ring. Obviously, probably the biggest performance and biggest result in the history of Donegal hurling was beating Kerry last year, because Kerry are a team that's operating at supposedly a level above. So we beat them last year, and we went down and gave them a hell of a game at the weekend there, and with 14 men for most of the match. I mean, most people thought Kerry would have serious revenge of their men and Donegal could be in trouble, but I just hats off to Mickey McCann, this team. I mean, what a performance. It's probably up there with the performance they gave last year as well. So major, major, major leaps being made by our hurlers.
And from that point of view, I mean, there's a look at the way hurling's developing in Donegal over the past number of years. I mean, when I started, you had basically Burt winning everything, Satanta trying to get a bit of a game, and a few hurlers in Unions. Now, I mean, it's now building up. You've got hurling developing in Unions. You've got hurling developing in Ballyshannon, Satanta and Burt maybe retaining the top dog situation. But more and more clubs are picking up on hurling in the county, and it is starting to come through.
Yeah, and there's a proper development strategy, and I think that's the big thing. I don't know, when you look at different teams, so Four Masters, Dunlow, Sizeagus, all getting involved, and then what you're seeing is, you know, even Dunlow County player coming through then in terms of like bolstering, I suppose, the pick and the spread. Because, you know, if you look at Unions, for example, my own club, you've got some dual players, but predominantly lads are either playing hurling or football, and you know it's a different, completely different game. So I mean, there's loads of people out there that maybe football, hurling is a game that suits them better, but they need the opportunity to play it. And same as I say, Camogie's back in terms of at a county perspective as well. Donegal County team is back as well. So all that's great in terms of promoting the GAA and getting people playing sport, which is the number one. You know, you look at, we talk so much about the winners and the big teams and all that, but the reality is that the GAA is about participation, whether that be supporting parents going to games with their kids, you know, the level of relationships they build and the friends they build through that. And that's really what the GAA is about. You know, we always talk about the big teams and the ones and that, but the GAA is about the people.
And the reality is, I suppose, if you go to a county like Kilkenny or Tipperary or Waterford or one of those, I mean, kids are born with hurlies welded to their hands pretty much. I mean, you know, and it's very rare you'd look at kids going to school without at least half of them carrying hurls with them, like on the way to school. That mightn't be on the verge of happening in Donegal anytime soon, but it is great to see hurling develop more and more in the county, and maybe we'll see. You know, Donegal have won Division 4 championships in the past in hurling, so I mean, there's been Nicky Rackard success in the county as well. So I mean, you know, there is pedigree there. There is. I always say to Colin Brannock, actually, I mean, you know, I think Colin Brannock's the only Waterford man to lift a trophy in Croke Park in about the past 50 years. Yeah. I always have a bit of a joke with Colin about that over the years when they took the Nicky Rackard there a couple of years ago. But no, there is some hurling pedigree in Donegal, and great to see that being built on.
Yeah, fantastic, Don. As you said, the Waterford man, you know all about the small ball. But Don, you know, you look at where Donegal, if you look at Kerry, for example, Kerry are going to be operating in the division next year with Waterford. You know, that's the level that Kerry are trying to get up to, that next level. So the fact that Donegal are mixing it with them, and they're going to be playing your own men next year, it just shows you the levels of Donegal. Like 5-6 years ago, Donegal couldn't have been in the mix with that type of pedigree, but that's the advancement they're making, so fair play to you all.
Excellent, Brendan. We look forward to it. So just to repeat, the DL debate tonight, it's coming live from the clubhouse in O'Donnell Park, previewing obviously the game against Down this coming weekend. Rory Kavanagh, Charlie McGrew, Niall O'Donnell, Tyrone legend Ronan McNamee as well. Now, One thing I want to ask you, we're all taking it for granted. Look, this is Down. Now, Down have a couple of All-Ireland championships over the past couple of decades. I mean, there's almost an expectation. Okay, Down are going to come to Letterkenny, Donegal will take care of Down, and then obviously we'll have the matches in into the future. Is it a foregone conclusion, or will Down give him a game?
Yes. Was that a good enough answer for you?
To which?
Quick. Sometimes you have to view people very quick. You've got to be ready for that next question. No, don't listen. In terms of systems and how teams play, you know, like nothing's left a chance. Football used to be an on-the-day thing where there was an odd giant killing act, and you still will see it now from certain teams. If you look at Westmeath beating Meath yesterday, no one really seen that coming. Meath were potential outside All-Ireland contenders. Yeah. I know it was a big stretch, but certainly they were odds big favourites and they were put it up them. So you're always guarded against that. But I think with Donegal, how they're playing, the system that they play in that, it's so difficult for a team like Down to shut us down. Whereas Down are playing through players like McGuinness, Murdoch, Haveron. They play through certain players, whereas Donegal, there's no one you can actually just say, oh, I need to mark him and him. The whole 11 need to be stopped and everybody's coming with it. And I think that's what differentiates Donegal, and that's why it makes them such favourites for this week's championship.
So as far as you're concerned, there's no need to worry, no need for any concern at all. Donegal have got this in the bag, and it's
Down. That's the thing, and then talk. Jim McGuinness will be turning down the radio now.
Oh, yeah, of course. No.
As you said, you know, I think that's a big thing, actually. Donald was managing expectations. Meath now have been put up in a bit of a pedestal, whereas last year they were a common team, and that, I think, affected them, and that's why Westmeath maybe had a cut of them. I think Donegal are at a different stage now. Listen, there's a big game and plan for Donegal, and certainly if they're going to go where they need to go this year, Down playing Division 3, you know, aren't going to be able to, I think, cope with Donegal. They did give us a game last year for a while, but certainly we have just so much firepower that, you know, it's only the inevitability is we'll win the game, yeah.
Okay, look, Brendan, thanks very much indeed. Greg will be talking to you next week, of course, and we look forward to hearing you over the course of the week, and indeed look forward to hearing the show tonight. Thank you very much indeed, Brendan. I want to talk to you about water quality in the Glenties Municipal District, because Lisa McDaniel joins us on the line, and Lisa is Community Water Officer in Donegal. She's working with LawPro, which is the local authority's water programme, and it oversees water quality in rivers, lakes, estuaries and ground and coastal waters. There is a discussion ongoing about water quality in the Glenties Municipal District, and as part of that process, a meeting is taking place this week. Lisa, good morning to you.
Good morning, Donald. Thanks for having us on.
It's our absolute pleasure. Lisa, this is an important one because obviously we know from the EPA reports that most water in Donegal is of excellent quality, and we know that Donegal has got some great swimming waters, some great angling waters, some great fishing waters, and we pride ourselves in this county on our environmental cleanliness for the most part. But there are problems and there are issues, and maybe this meeting this week will highlight some of what needs to be looked at in the West Donegal area. Talk to us about this meeting on Wednesday.
Well, the water quality in Donegal is kind of half and half. You know, we've got some excellent water quality, which we need to keep at high status. So, like, really, we've got the lovely 31 blue dots, so the best water quality around along our coastal waters and in some of the headlands of some of our rivers. But we do have some rivers that are struggling. So their health has been impacted by various different things over the years. So we need to give them a bit of a hand, okay? So on Wednesday evening, we're having a community meeting to discuss water quality. So this is an opportunity for anybody to come along, and we welcome everybody to come along that has any interest, has any concern about water quality in the Glenties district. So it's taking place in Anshan Farak in Falkara. So it's this Wednesday evening, the 22nd of April at 7 p.m. And basically, it's an opportunity to come along and listen to some of the work that we're doing in the area. So we have a scientific team, and they would be looking, they'd be working on rivers that would be struggling with their water quality status. So they'll be talking about some of the work that is taking place at the moment. And then I'll be talking about some of the amazing work that some of the local community groups are doing to improve water quality in the area as well. It's been recognised in the National Water Action Plan that communities are key to improving water quality, because we can't be everywhere, and community groups and landowners are the eyes and ears on the ground. So if anybody would like to come along and learn from what we're doing, but most importantly for us, it's to learn from the local people. We also will have representatives from several different agencies that are involved in water quality. And we've got people there from Acres Donegal, from Chagas, and from the Farming for Water EIP. And these all provide funding for landowners to put measures on their ground to improve their local water quality. So we'll have some short presentations, but most importantly will be the cup of tea and the chats afterwards, because we really want to know what's happening out there. And this is the opportunity for people to come along and do that, give us that information.
Obviously, you're going to be working closely. You're going to be working closely with the Environmental Protection Agency and others just to monitor exactly what's happening on rivers. And I'm sure they give you the heads up if they notice any problems in their testing. Indeed, you're probably carrying out a lot of the testing on their behalf as well locally. So between your work with the EPA and your work on the ground, you've got a fairly good idea of the situation overall. But how important is it that you do have the community as your eyes and ears? How important is it that if people notice something suspect, if people notice something potentially off in their own local river, lake, whatever, that they come to you?
Absolutely, yeah. We ran one of these meetings last year, and the group came along, and they highlighted something in a small stream that we probably never would have seen. And it was having a direct impact on the local river. So as I said, people are out there, they can see what's happening in their local area. I would work with community groups throughout the county and would speak to people on a regular basis over their concerns and issues. But for this area, for this Glenties Municipal District, which is huge, this is the opportunity for people to come along. The reason why we're holding it in Balcarra is the Tullahoe-Begley River, one of the rivers that run into Balcarra, is one of our priority action areas. So we're actually studying this river in detail at the moment to try and identify what issues are having an impact on its health. So if you live along this river, if you have land, if you're a farmer along this river, if you have a recreational interest in this river, please come along to learn a little bit more about this scientific work that's carrying on. We've got several grants for communities to do a whole array of different actions that will help water quality. And I will be talking about those grants, and I'll be able to give information to any groups that would be interested in applying for them.
And presumably what you learn about this river in Balcarra is something that could be used in your assessments of other rivers and other problems. A problem that develops in one area could be replicated elsewhere, and every piece of learning in one area is something that potentially can be applied to another situation.
Yeah, it can do, but I find that every water body has its own story, because it's got, every place is different. It's got different pressures, which we call pressures are like impacts. One river it could be forestry, one river it could be farming, one river it could be, a pollution incident, or it could be something coming from the town. So every river, every water body has different pressures, and that's why we have to look at them individually and really study them in detail, and that will give us the opportunity to try and find how to resolve them and what agencies we need to collaborate with to improve it in the future.
A caller is asking, why is the meeting so far from the centres of population in the Glenties electoral area, and why is the EPA not testing the water between Duhurry and the Guibarra Bridge?
I can find out information from EPA if you can send me that on. I wouldn't know the answer to that. And as I just stated there, the reason why it's been taking place in Balcarra is because the Tullaghbegley is the priority action area that we're working on at the moment. So it's very important for us to get that information, especially on that river at the moment.
Excellent. Lisa McDaniel, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. And that meeting is taking place Wednesday evening in Anshanvarak in Falkara. What time does it get underway?
It starts at 7 p.m. So probably around 8:30. But as I said, it's very important that we listen to everyone's concern, and we'll be having a cup of tea. So we won't be racing off, but it'd be great to see as many people as possible.
And as we all know, very often it's the conversations over the cup of tea turn out to be the most important ones, and that's where you get the really interesting knowledge
so
on and so forth.
Yeah.
Okie doke, Lisa, thank you very much indeed, and hopefully you'll get a very good turnout.
Thank you so much, Donal.
Okie doke. Well,
thank you. Goodbye.
Take care. Cheers. You take care now. Bye-bye. You'll have heard on the news with Ryan earlier that Aer Lingus have announced a number of cancellations. Around about 500 flights are being cancelled over the course of the summer. And in the current context, that's obviously led to some concerns among people that their summer holiday plans may be impacted. Now, the Irish Travel Agents Association has been moving this morning to try and quell some of the fears that have been expressed around that. And delighted to say that we're joined on Zoom this morning by Emma McHugh, who is the owner of Atlantic Travel in Letterkenny and also a member of the Irish Travel Agents Association. Emma, good morning to you.
Good morning, Donal.
Emma, in terms of this, what we're hearing today is that these are routine maintenance cancellations, that they'll be done on high-frequency flight routes, and that the ordinary customer over the course of the summer should not be affected. Do you share that confidence?
Yeah, this has been a rolling thing with Aer Lingus, and the piece that has caught people's attention in the last couple of days actually was issued on the 8th of April. So the plan was put in place then. Now, Aer Lingus are saying that it is routine maintenance issues, and I suppose that's what we need to take it as at the moment. Anyone that has been affected already by those flights that have been cancelled either have been offered a refund or reaccommodated on the same route either a day before or a day after, depending on the frequency of the route that has been affected.
So the suggestion is that if you are booked on a service that maybe goes once or twice a week and is a fairly specialist flight, the chances are that will not be impacted by this particular move.
Correct. Like, I suppose if you look at the network and the frequency of flights, depending on where they go to, you could have Malaga where you could have, you know, in the peak, you could have 6-7 flights a day. If it was one of those routes, you know, the impact is going to be minimal. So they would probably look at consolidating flights. So you go from 7 to 6 on a route, perhaps where you may have less frequency, where it might be a morning flight and an evening flight, or maybe a daily. That's where the most impact will be seen. So, you know, the flexibility around the customer to be able to travel a day before or a day after will depend on the circumstances of why they're traveling. But the accommodation will be there to either move their flight or to get a refund.
What probably hasn't helped is, as this was coming out and coming into the public consciousness, we were also hearing from the European Energy Agency that there is something in the region of about a 6-week reserve of aircraft fuel left within the European Union at the moment. People are looking at the Strait of Hormuz and the supply situation and asking themselves, with all the best will in the world, the airlines might want to make the flights, but if the fuel isn't there, will they be able to? And the fact that those two have come together, what are you hearing from your own sources? And I'm sure you're speaking regularly to the airlines and the fuel suppliers and everybody else. What are you hearing about this supply situation? Is it something we should be concerned about?
I think as time goes by and if the situation doesn't change, there will be, I suppose, people will be affected by schedule changes. But at this point in time, we haven't, and I've spoken to, I suppose, some airline representatives this morning and some of the Irish tour operators and also Jet2, who would have a huge volume out of Belfast. And at the moment, there has been no changes in terms of fuel surcharges as well. There's been nothing affected at the moment in terms of people who have already booked either placed a deposit or if they've paid in full. So that's a very positive thing we're looking at the moment. But I suppose we're not going to know more until the situation either evolves or resolves. And the further we go into the summer, should airlines look at thinning some of their schedules, we would be looking at a consolidation of flights, like I spoke about that just there. The main routes will be the ones that will be least affected. So, you know, your summer sun, your flights that are booked out all of the time will, you know, run on a frequency maybe going from 5 or 6 a day to 4 or 5 a day. People won't be affected in terms of being able to get there, but the people that haven't booked yet are going to be the ones that will see the price increase, because there's going to be less seats available for the summer if flights are consolidated.
Now, I am, and I will state an interest in this, because I'm sort of speaking about my own experience here. But I remember back in the past, cruising in particular, at the time of the 08, 09, 2010, when we had the financial crisis at that point, it was a regular statement that you get fuel surcharges added on to a cost of whatever, 10 or 20 euro per day per passenger or whatever. And, I mean, people that will have cruises, say, booked into the summer, into the autumn, even into early next year, what mm-hmm. are the chances of them seeing fuel surcharges imposed on those particular trips? And is there any advantage in paying in full now on the basis that it's maybe less likely that one paid off in full will incur a fuel surcharge than one which perhaps is to be paid off in June, July or whenever?
Yeah, I suppose at the moment, what I can say is that from all the cruise companies that we've dealt with, we haven't seen that either spoken about or mentioned in terms of fuel surcharges. As we go further into the summer, if you've booked a package under the Package Travel Directive, there are terms and conditions that will allow a tour operator increase up to 8%, not in general terms, but in relation to fuel charges and taxes. Now, each and every tour operator will have their own terms and conditions, but that piece is the legislation under the Travel Package Directive. And each of them will have, I suppose, their own terms and conditions. So it's very, very hard for me to say that should this be ongoing come October or November later on in the year, that we won't see increases on new bookings. In terms of existing ones, we've been told at the moment, no.
Right. Well, it's a situation obviously we're going to be looking at with interest. Talk to me in general about the trends for 2026. Let's just park fuel issues and Iran and all that to one side.
Yeah.
What are the trending destinations in 2026? What's changed over the past couple of years?
Oh, it is still very, very strong in Europe. We have, you know, in recent years, Irish consumer has been a lot more adventurous in going to, say, the likes of Vietnam, Cambodia, Asia, Indonesia, and Dubai, the Gulf states. That obviously at the moment has halted. So we are seeing those people who would have maybe gone east, they're now looking at going west. So Mexican, Caribbean, if they still want to do long haul. A lot of people are still looking at the Western Med, is still very, very strong for this summer. So the likes of the Balearics, the Canaries, Malta, France, Spain, Italy, Croatia is very, very strong at the moment as well. Where we are seeing people avoiding booking or a disinclination to look at is the likes of, say, Turkey, some of the Greek islands as well. Bookings have fallen off for that. And obviously the Dubai piece is paused at the moment. There is a DFA instruction actually about, avoid all travel, even transiting through it.
Yeah.
Which is an important note, because we in Donegal, we have a huge amount of family and friends visit via Gulf out to
Australia,
in
New
Australia.
Zealand. Yeah.
And, you know, we would have a lot of customers that have been affected, and it's just to bear in mind, there may be a flight coming home via the Gulf, but when there's a DFA there, any travel insurance is null and void, and there is cause for concern for disruption. So, you know, rerouting people on alternative methods via anywhere else but there is what's being done at the moment. But that obviously is much more expensive because demand is high.
Without referencing any political figures and any politics per se, we know that a couple of months ago there was concern expressed when it became known that the US would be looking to examine people's social media accounts and look at their posts and see if they said anything negative about any individuals and so on and so forth. Has that had an impact on travel to the US?
Do you know what? It hasn't. And I'm surprised. we haven't seen a drop off, but what we have noticed and we've come across in the last, I would say, 6 to 9 months, is people that would have been approved for their ESTA visa online need to always recheck and don't take it as a given that that remains an approval. We have had people where it has been declined between the point where they got approved online and their point of travel. And that is what we are finding is happening more often. We haven't had anybody stopped in Dublin because, as you know, you can do immigration in Dublin going to the States. But we have had people with issues with their ESTA that it has been reneged on once it has been approved. So, you know, I would always urge people not to just take it that it's approved. Just keep an eye on it because that does happen and it has been happening.
And is there a time frame that they should be checking? Is it, or can that happen at any time after it's been approved?
It can happen at any time, which is unfortunate, and it's very frustrating for those on the other end of that when they have, you know, they might have their flights booked and accommodation booked, or, you know, it could be going for family weddings or arrangements and stuff. Now, we have seen people being able to get it reinstated, but it you know, it causes stress and for those who are caught on the hop at the last minute, it can be extremely stressful. So it's just one piece of advice to keep an eye if you have an ESTA approval, just to make sure that it's still valid.
Yeah. Emma, thanks so much indeed for that. And that is important advice if anyone is travelling stateside, either for a holiday in the States or visiting whatever, or indeed as the jump off point for further travel, be it at sea or wherever, that they should really take a look at that. We're going to leave it there, Emma, for the moment. Thank you very much indeed. And we will keep an eye on the whole situation as it unfolds with interest, and all of us with personal interest as well, because I'm sure all of us have something booked over.
We're all dying to get away.
We are indeed, and hopefully we will. But for the moment, Emma, thank you very much indeed. Now, a caller says, I didn't know traffic wardens can give fines for no tax display. My car is taxed, but one of the children had moved it, and now I haven't seen it. So I've been taxed. I suppose you're going to have to get in touch with the council on that one and try to have the situation resolved, caller. Another caller says, I'm an Air Business customer. They are retrieving money from last year. They have accumulated a cost and I'm now being charged. My bill was €400. It's normally 80. Has this happened to anybody else? Are they paying it? Is the customer at fault? That is an interesting question. If you've had issues with Air, maybe get in touch with us. And caller, all I can suggest is get in touch with Air directly and try and talk to them and try and figure something out. We're going to go back to Zoom now, and we're going to speak to Councillor Declan Meehan about a meeting that's taking place in Rathmullen with a view towards setting up a town team. Now, Declan, you've been involved very much in the town team in Milford, and that's been a huge success, and important to see that happen in Rathmullen as well.
Yeah, this is fantastic, Donal, to see this finally getting underway. There's an awful lot of various projects in Rathmullen that, you know, I suppose have been taken to a certain stage with regards to planning, particularly prior to planning for a number of projects. And there is another project that has been taken up to detailed design. And this is all part of, I suppose, a larger rural regeneration initiative in Rathmullen to unlock the potential, primarily for locals, but also for visitors to beautiful Rathmullen. So I suppose one of the things that drives this forward is under our Rural Future policy document from the Department of Rural and Community Development is the establishment of a town team. And what that does is it brings together all local stakeholders, residents, business owners, community and sports groups, schools, etc., churches as well, so that everyone can have their say about the direction that rural regeneration takes in a given town or village. So this is an exciting opportunity for everyone who is interested in Rathmullen to get involved. That drop-in event is taking place in the St Vincent de Paul Centre from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. next Wednesday. So I'd encourage anyone who's interested in the regeneration of Rathmullen to come along to that. It'll be an excellent opportunity for them to have their say about all of the various projects that we're looking to deliver in Rathmullen with the council's support.
And then can I just confirm that's Wednesday, April 29th?
Correct, yes, the 29th of April, Wednesday week.
Yeah, exactly. You will have had experience of the situation in Milford, both in terms of your work as a councillor and indeed as your work as a community development worker in that area for quite a while. From your point of view and from Donegal County Council's point of view, What have you learned from your experience in Milford and the council's experience elsewhere that you're going to bring to Rathmullen, perhaps more equipped and better able to hone in on what's important under this scheme and to really target specifically where it can best benefit the area?
Yeah, look, I suppose, as you say, Donald, we have had success in Milford by bringing all stakeholders together. We also recently have set up a town team in Nadunav and Downings, and that is just getting up and running with the first committee meeting taking place next week as well. So these town teams, there's a lot to be learned from them. And the key thing there is that if you're not sitting at the table, you're not going to be heard. So again, the important thing is to encourage as many people to come to the drop-in event for people to have their say. I think there's great strength in having these town teams because it means that neither councillors nor council staff are making decisions for communities in isolation. And that key element to this process is engaging with people who are living in communities, who are working in communities, and who know best what those communities need. There's really exciting opportunities in Rathmullen because Rathmullen has been earmarked and targeted for a funding application to the Rural Regeneration Development Fund this year under Category 1. There has been a number of setbacks and disappointments in Rathmullen over the years where applications have not been successful. And we hope that this one that we're progressing with the council this year will be successful. So I think the most important thing is that as many community stakeholders as possible engage with this process, sit at the table, come together, have all viewpoints aired and listened to, and then move forward collectively. Because, look, as you said there, Donal, I come from a background and I'm still working in community development and in rural regeneration, as well as being a county councillor. And, you know, the vast majority of people working in community development, whether it's with their local St. Vincent de Paul, their local sports club, whatever it is, festival committees, etc., they're all volunteers. And as such, they're all focused on their own projects and their own programmes. But the beauty of a town team is bringing all those people together in order to enhance, cooperation and collaborative working and to get a real sense of what a community wants and needs.
And I suppose, too, you were talking about funding and the fact that there's been a couple of proposals for Rathmullen that haven't been funded. If something is coming through the town team, as you said, it has the stated support of the community, it has the involvement of the community, and presumably something that has that force of community backing that's come through a town team process is more likely to qualify for funding and is more likely to be possibly considered by the various departments and funding agencies.
Well, that's exactly it. You're trying to tick all the boxes when you go for an application for, rural regeneration funding is in the millions, so it's significant funding. And you're trying to tick as many of the boxes as the department are looking for. And having that strong collaborative and cooperative piece is a prerequisite, really, and certainly puts you in a stronger position to secure that funding. And one of the things that I would have pushed for during the budget negotiations at the County Council in December was for an action plan and town team to be set up in Rathmullen in order to strengthen applications going forward. So it is exactly that. It gives a lot more credibility to an application going forward. And it also complements the really hard work that the rural regeneration team in Donegal County Council are doing when they're making these applications. These aren't, you know, two sides of an A4 application forms. These are extensive and very, very, labour-intensive applications. So having that town team in place really does strengthen it. And it's an important component then of the application going forward.
Councillor Declan Meehan, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. That's exciting times coming up. And Wednesday week, April 29th at 7 p.m. in the St. Vincent de Paul Centre. Get to that meeting in Rathmullen if you want to have a say in its future. Right now, we're going to stay in the Milford electoral area. We're going to go to line one and say good morning to Councillor Pádraig McGarvey. Pádraig, good morning to you.
Good morning, Donal.
Pádraig, you are speaking to us about something unfortunate that's been happening in the Remelton area, and we love reporting on the positive things that are happening in Remelton, Rathmullen and so on and so forth. But sadly, we also have to report on what's happened over the weekend.
Exactly, Donal, and unfortunately, I've got a report there this past couple of hours from Donegal County Council that the And I suppose this has been ongoing now this past couple of weeks, but they've been repaired and fixed and damaged again. But this morning now and yesterday evening was a sight that I suppose the council has come on. And unfortunately, the toilets has been severely damaged and remelting there yesterday during the day. It was unveiled whenever the council staff went to close the toilets yesterday evening, and I suppose the damage has been, it's very bad now. The doors, the sinks, the locks has been bust, and I suppose we just wanted to highlight it and try and stomp out this vandalism, because it's a great facility in Remelton, mm-hmm. and I suppose we've been working towards getting funding to upgrade the facility in recent months through the Donegal County Council Environment section. And I suppose this toilet is actually managed by the council itself, so I suppose Remelton is lucky that that is actually managed by the council and a member of staff. And unfortunately, the member of staff came on this yesterday evening, and just I suppose he's had enough, and I suppose we want it to be stomped out. And the guards have been contacted, so unfortunate that that has come to this, but the toilets have been made operational again today, but they're not fully functional.
And the other issue now is the opening times have been reduced, and presumably the concern is a lot of this vandalism is happening at night, so the toilets are now going to close at 5 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah, and I suppose the toilets are providing a service to the workmen there. There's great works going on in Remelton there, the regeneration, and there's a group of contractors there, and I suppose they're using it, and it's unfortunately now that we have to close them at 5 p.m. until we try and stop this.
Is there anything Gardaí can do, be it use of CCTV or whatever, to try and get to the bottom of this? Because if it's happened on a number of occasions, the question then gets raised, is it the same people doing this over and over again? And if so, what can be done to actually stop this?
Yeah, well, I suppose the guards have a job now to do. I suppose it was only reported to the guards, yeah. So they have, I suppose, inquiries to make. CCTV around public toilets and all, there is, unfortunately, there's CCTV can't be used around public toilets. There's a process that has to be taken there. But the guards have a job to do, and I would ask the members of the public or anybody in Remelton that's seen anybody about the toilets this past couple of weeks or hanging about to contact the guards in Milford. That would help their investigations.
Councillor Pádraig McGarvey, thank you very much indeed. We'll certainly keep an eye on that situation. Okie doke, Pádraig, thank you. So that's the public toilets in Remelton vandalised over the course of the weekend. It was discovered yesterday, and the immediate impact of that is that as of this evening, those toilets which have been reopened this morning, and fair play to the council staff for actually getting them reopened, but they are now going to be closed from 5 o'clock in the evening. And it's a wonderful town, Remelton, and it's an awful shame to see that. So hopefully that issue can be addressed. Now we're joined on the line by An Tahar Brino Fari, who is the parish priest in Gwydor. Tahar Brian, Majinwa.
Majinwa, did you want it? Just a lot. It's wonderful to be with you.
Thank you, Father Brian. I'll begin, and I did say this to you off air, but I was watching the funeral mass for the late Moira Ní Bheinán online on Friday afternoon. It was a funeral service that absolutely did justice to a wonderful woman, and I think I can say on behalf of everybody in Donegal and further afield, Gura Mahagoth, and thank you for doing justice to a wonderful lady.
You're right, she was a wonderful lady. She was one who was, and Moira, as you know, and your listeners will know, she was a gentlewoman. She was gifted and grounded and just deeply rooted in Gwydor. And it was an absolute privilege to be able to play a part, a small part that I did in sending her to her heavenly home. So thank you for that. And I think that she's left a wonderful legacy behind her. And not just of music, but of love and friendship and kindness. And it's up to us now to carry that baton and go forward from here with it.
Yeah. Amen to that. Father, and it's hard to believe that it's a year since that fire that devastated St Mary's Church in Derrybeg. It was a disaster for the community, but also it was something that I think brought a community together like very few things we've seen in Donegal in recent years.
You're right, Donal, in what you're saying. It's a year tomorrow, in fact, to the calendar year, and it was a huge shock and a huge loss and for the community. There's no doubt about that. But you're right in pointing out that it has brought people together, and you know, that even though the building was lost, the people's faith and the kindness and the generosity of the people haven't been lost. And so it's just about kind of going forward from here now, and it's working through that grief process, I suppose, and then just going to the rebuilding process. And that's what we're at now at the moment. It's been a lot of work in that past year. A lot of work has happened, a lot of work has been done behind the scenes and so on. And I'm just looking, standing here at the moment, just looking up at where the church stood, and it's just an empty sight of them. Well, bar the sacristy, that's what's left of the sacristy, and that will have to come down in due course, of course. But it's, we have that determination, you know, that, and we have that we're moving forward, and we're moving in the right direction. And a lot of, as I said, a lot of preparatory work has gone into getting us to this stage. And although we don't have, and the community don't see brick and mortar on the site there yet,
yeah,
but that'll happen in due course. But there's a lot of overspoilage, as we call it, preparatory work that has to go in beforehand.
The architects are appointed and are working, and we understand you will very shortly be in a position where the community can be presented with development draft designs and a possible vision of where you're going with the development of a new St Mary's Church.
Yeah, that's right. We've an architect, Carl Pedersen from Mullarky Pedersen Architects in Derry. And he's working on his design at the moment, and he's at the advanced stage with that. And he'll be presenting that to the community for the his design is based on his own, obviously, any architect. I'm sure that when they sit down to design a church, they pull their own thoughts and designs to ideas together. But also feeding into that is we had a public consultation a number of months back. And just ask the community, what did you like about the church? What didn't you like? What would you like in the new church? And what have you seen in other churches that you think would be nice here? And so all of these things feed into it. And he's been in the community here a number of times. He's met with sort of interest groups in the community, with the elderly and with students in the public school of Idoa, and with the choir particularly, because I'm very conscious that we have a very strong choir in the parish here, and liturgical music, Ath Gael, it has a deep tradition and deeply rooted in the parish here. You mentioned Moya. We spoke about Moya Nivrenan earlier on there, and her mother was the choir director here at one stage, Baba. And in fact, her father, he was the choir director in Mina Wheel Church as well. But so it's important that all of this is kind of taken into. We don't want it to be an afterthought, you know, that where are we going to place the choir or so on. All of these things will have to feed into the initial design. So that's what the architect is at the moment. He's pulling all of these, and he'll be back again in the parish and then next week, and he'll meet with a few other people as well and groups, and all of that will feed into his designs. And once he has his designs secured, and he'll go to the bishop, of course, as well. He'll have to meet with our new bishop that's been installed recently. And because the final say is always, not just in our own project here in Guido, but any church project, there's that ecclesiastical authority that the bishop is the one who signs off on any church design and so on. So he'll have to feed in as well. And I met with him initially there last week, just to bring him up to speed of what we've come through, where we're at, and the work, the amazing work. And can I just say that Michal Widde, we have a committee that in the parish here, a group that I pulled together, people of different professions, professionalism in their own right, and people that were needed to guide this project along through the insurance process. And we're nearly there with regards to finalising the insurance claim and so on, and then we'll move forward from there. So a lot of work has been done, and we're moving in the right direction.
And as you say, the insurance almost agreed that's progressing nicely. €500,000 raised as a result of the fundraising that got underway in the immediate aftermath of the fire. And that's a testament not only to the level of support within West Donegal, Guido, and Donegal in general. I mean, it's a testament to a level of support that's not just national. Yeah. It's obviously global.
Yeah, it is. You're very right in saying that, Owen. All right, because going forward, what we're going to have here in Guido, it's going to be a major financial undertaking to build a new church. And the important thing, I suppose, for us to do at the moment is just to let those professionals complete their works and their costings and so on. And just once that's all in place, then we'll have an accurate idea of what the costings will be for the new church that we want to build here. And then we can, you know, we're moving forward responsibly in that sense as well. And the insurance, as I mentioned, they're playing a very important part role here as well. And they've worked very well with us. There's an assessor there, Sean Ryan from Davies, who's been very, very supportive of us up until now, as has the insurance. The insurance company, they've worked with us step by step. And we've engaged positively with them and constructively with them, you know, and that's what we have to do. And so this, we're just examining the whole lot very carefully and very prudently with the insurance company. And then once that settlement is done, we'll know there where we stand with regards to finances. And you're right, you know, the people of Gweedore and our diaspora further afield, they have supported us immensely, and because they see this as their church, their spiritual home, and they want to contribute in any way. And I've had a lot of people saying as well that we'll help and support once we see building happening and building works going on, we'll come in behind as well. So our gratitude is just because really what it's not only have they supported us financially, but they've kind of, it's what they're saying is that this is our home, this is our spiritual home, this is our church as well. And We've seen them a lot of support, and just that donations from all over, and it's a work of communion, I suppose we could say that they are in communion with us, and you know, reminding that our church is that is truly Catholic,
and the church is chock on pubble. It's chock on pubble. It's the house of the people.
You hit the nail on the head there. That's exactly what it is. That it's universal in that sense. That it's reaching out to not my home or Father Brendan, who is the curate here with me. Certainly it's our home, but it's not, we don't own the church, so to speak, that in the sense that the priest, we will come and go into a community and we're moved to different parishes or whatever the case may be, but this is the people that's their spiritual home and their base. And but we are, I suppose, the kind of reflecting back now, as I stand here and look up at the church, there's a statue of Our Lady in the window here looking up towards the church, and I'm looking at Our Lady, our life, our sweetness and our hope, that she is our hope and she's the one that will strengthen us and help us kind of going forward. And just I suppose it's the year, the tomorrow with this year anniversary, that's just to thank the people. I want to thank that, just to say thank you for their patience and encouragement and just the solidarity that's been shown up in the past year. And even though what we lost was brick and mortar, but there was memory in those brick and mortar as well. And kind of going forward, we still have a lot of work to do, but we're moving forward with hope. And that's the important message here today.
And that will be done. Oh, Ferry, good to meet you, August Slán.
Good to meet you, August Slán.
And that's the Greg Hughes Show for today, Monday. Thank you to Shannon, thank you to Caroline for producing, and to Ushin and Canis indeed, and all who helped. I'm Donald Kavanagh. I'm back with you tomorrow. John's up next around the Northwest. But for now, from the Greg Hughes Show, good morning.